Welcome to the End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Over the last month or so, I've asked our listeners and subscribers to email topics or questions they want discussed on the podcast to me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. Boy, have they flooded me with suggestions. I've received hundreds and hundreds of emails wanting me to discuss lots of unanswered questions from November 22, 1963. One question I get asked a lot is, if Oswald was innocent of shooting President Kennedy, why did he leave the book depository after the assassination? And was Lee Harvey Oswald the only person missing from the depository that day? So we're going to look into that and try to answer that this week. As we start this new series on the podcast, I would just like to say thank you to all of our thousands of listeners and subscribers out there. We truly appreciate you listening in every week. I personally do not make one dime off this podcast, and don't expect to. I started this podcast because I'm passionate about this case, and I want people to know that there is more to the JFK assassination than our history books tells us. So once again, as we start this new series, if you've got questions or topics you want covered on the podcast, please email them to me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com, and we'll try to cover them. Our first question this week comes from Claudia in Springfield, Missouri. Claudia asks, if Oswald wasn't Kennedy's assassin, why did he leave the Texas School Book Depository shortly after the assassination? Claudia, that's a great question, and one that's been kicked around by researchers and historians for years. Actually, Oswald had no reason to leave the building, even if he had been the shooter. If he was planted there to shoot Kennedy, the most intelligent thing to do would be to remain in the building as if nothing happened. He was an employee. He belonged in the building. His presence there would not have aroused any suspicion. Even when the police found the gun, they would not have known it was Oswald's until later, and even then, they might not have discovered the gun was his until days later, if at all. Keep in mind, the only prints found on the weapon was a mysterious palm print. And that wasn't found until a late-night visit to the funeral home, where Oswald's body was being prepared for burial by funeral director Paul Grudy. Grudy said that FBI agents came late one night and asked to be alone with Oswald's body.
I had gotten to the funeral home with his body, something in the neighborhood of 11 o'clock at night, and it is a several-hour procedure to prepare the remains, and after this time, someplace in the early morning, agents came. Now, I say agents because I'm not familiar at the moment with whether they were Secret Service or FBI or what they were, but agents did come, and when they did come, they fingerprinted, and the only reason that we knew they did, they were carrying a satchel and equipment and asked us if they might have the preparation room to themselves. And after it was all over, we found ink on Lee Harvey's hands, showing that they had fingerprinted him and palm printed him. We had to take that ink back off in order to prepare him for burial and to eliminate that ink.
Keep in mind, Oswald only becomes a suspect when he leaves the building. Why he leaves is anyone's guess. I have my own thoughts, and I will share those with you in just a minute. If he was the shooter, maybe he panicked. He clearly wasn't thinking rationally, judging from his actions. First, he walks north on Houston Street along the side of the Texas School Book Depository. When he gets to the loading dock at the rear of the building, he does an about-face and retraces his steps, heading south on Houston Street back towards Elm. If he were trying to make a getaway, continuing north on Houston Street would have been logical. Co-worker Buell Wesley Frazier, standing on the corner of Elm and Houston, sees Oswald cross Houston Street and start to walk east on Elm Street before losing him in the crowd.
I was standing on the top step of the entrance into the Texas School Book Depository. I stand there talking to two people, and they were trying to figure out what happened themselves. And I look to my left, and there comes Lee Oswald walking down beside the building. Very normal, no hurry. And he went across Houston Street. Somebody said something to me, and I looked to see who was speaking to me. And I turned back, and I lost him in the crowd. That's the last time I saw it.
Oswald then continues to walk east on Elm Street before getting on a bus headed west, back towards Dealey Plaza. This is the Marcellus bus, the one Oswald normally rides to and from his rooming house in Oak Cliff. Had he been thinking rationally, he would not have gotten on the bus because he knew that there was a huge traffic jam in Dealey Plaza. The bus would have to pass through on its normal route. Keep in mind that Oswald was not the only person to leave the depository building after the assassination. There were at least 15 other people who worked in the Texas School Book Depository who either went outside to watch the parade and never came back inside, or left early to go shopping or do other things and did not return. The police put out the APB alerts for two of these people, Charles Givens and Buell Wesley Frazier. Both were arrested and taken to the Dallas Police Headquarters for questioning. Had Oswald not been implicated in the shooting of J.D. Tippit, it's possible he would not have come under suspicion, even after he left the building. Like I stated earlier, most are under the mistaken impression that no one other than Lee Harvey Oswald left the Texas School Book Depository at the time of President Kennedy's assassination. Remarks made in numerous books, documentaries, and podcasts regarding Lee Harvey Oswald as being the only Texas School Book Depository employee missing after the assassination are in great error. That's what the Warren Commission and fans of the Lone Nut Theory want you to believe. This information I'm about to share is now readily available, but it wasn't at the time I discovered it buried in the Dallas Municipal Archives some 25 years ago. Some 15 persons are missing from the depository after the assassination. Oswald was never the sole missing depository employee. This is the list of missing employees who also worked at the depository and left the building without notifying building supervisor Roy Truly. Danny Acree left at 1 p.m., accompanied by police to go to City Hall. Carolyn Arnold left at 12:25 p.m. and did not return. Virgie Rackley left at 11:45 a.m. and returned at 12:40 p.m., but was denied entry. Jack Carson, president of the Texas School Book Depository, left at 12:10 p.m. and did not return. Betty Drago left at 12:20 p.m. but found the door locked when she returned. She stayed outside the depository until 2:30 p.m. before going home. Buell Wesley Frazier famously gave Oswald a lift to work that day. He left the depository between 1 and 2 p.m., about the same time Truly claims he made his roll call. Charles Givens returned to the depository after the shooting but was refused entry by the Dallas police. An APB was put out for him along with Buell Wesley Frazier, and he was later interviewed at City Hall by Captain Will Fritz. Truly was aware of Givens' absence, having seen him prior to the assassination. Truly also saw Oswald prior to his encounter with him in the second floor lunchroom. Using that logic, Oswald should have been exonerated as well. Gloria Holt left at 12:10 p.m. and did not return. Stella Jacob left at noon and did not return. Judy Johnson was standing outside the depository when the shooting began. She remained in the area until 2 p.m. and then went home. Dolores Canoes left at 12:15 p.m. and stayed outside until 3 p.m. Sharon Nelson left at 12:20 p.m. and never returned. She lived at 409 East 9th Street, near the site where Officer J.D. Tippit was gunned down. Roberta Parker left at a time unknown, and she says she wasn't allowed back until 3:30 p.m. Bonnie Ritchie left the building at 12:20 p.m. and never returned. Lloyd Viles left at 12:15 p.m. and returned at 2:55 p.m. Vita Watley left at 12:15 p.m. to go shopping. She tried to re-enter the depository at 1 p.m., but was denied entry by the police, so she went home. Bonnie Ray Williams accompanied Danny Acree to the police station at 1 p.m. So was Lee Harvey Oswald the only employee missing from the Texas School Book Depository after the assassination? The answer to that is absolutely not. So the next time you hear this on a podcast or a documentary, you can confidently say it's an absolute lie.
By now, police knew that Oswald was the only employee missing from the school book depository.
My opinion as to why Oswald left the depository after the assassination is this. Basically, Oswald knew at this point he had been set up to take the blame for shooting of the president. Whether he thought he was there that day to infiltrate or stop the assassination, or to do another job, I think it was at this point Oswald knew he had been set up to possibly take the fall, or be the patsy like he would later say. All my years of research tells me that Oswald was a CIA operative, having been recruited while in the U.S. Marine Corps, because he was proficient in Russian. I go into a lot of detail how there is proof he worked for U.S. intelligence in my book, The End of Innocence. He was stationed at a top-secret naval air base in Japan. He allegedly defected to the Soviet Union, but returned to America with his new wife, Marina. Surprisingly, he was never interviewed on his return. It was at this stage that the legend for his ultimate demise was created. He started to work for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in the summer of 1963 in New Orleans. This was a front for the CIA to recruit and train Cuban exiles for the Bay of Pigs invasion. The offices of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee were in the same office as FBI agent Guy Bannister, and it was across the street from the Office of Naval Intelligence.
This was in 63.
Sure, Guy Bannister, ex-FBI man, died a couple years ago.
Bannister headed the Chicago office. When he retired, he became a private eye here. I used to have lunch with him. John Birch Society, Minuteman.
Oh, yeah, I remember
slightly
that.
Slightly to the right of Attila the Hun. He used to recruit college students, infiltrate radical organizations on campus. Headed the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, all out of this office. Come around here, I want to show you something. See that? Now take a look here. 544 Camp Street. 531 Lafayette Street. Same building, right? But with different addresses and different entrances. Both going to the same place. To the office upstairs. Guess who used this address? Lee Harvey Oswald. Now how do we know he was here? Because this office address was stamped on the pro-Castro leaflets he was handing out in the summer of 63 down on Canal Street. Now, these are the same leaflets they found in his garage in Dallas.
What's this? What the hell is this doing on this piece of paper?
After the arrest, 544 Camp Street never appeared on the pamphlets again.
Yes.
He was arrested that day for fighting with some anti-Castro Cubans. But actually, he had contacted them a few days earlier as an ex-Marine trying to join their anti-Castro crusade. When they heard he was now pro-Castro, well, they paid him a visit.
What is this be that shit? You lied to me, you hypocrite. Liar, you son of a bitch. People, do not take this paper. This is communist propaganda.
Hey, Collins.
Come on, you piece of shit. Go back to Moscow.
There was no real fight, and the arresting lieutenant later said he felt it was a stage incident. In jail, Oswald has a private session with Special Agent John Quigley of the FBI. Oswald is released, and Quigley destroys his notes from the interview. The arrest gets him a lot of publicity, and as a result, Oswald appears on a local TV debate.
But you are a communist, are you not?
No, Mr. Bringier. I am not a communist. I'm Marxist-Leninist.
You are not a communist, but you are a Marxist-Leninist? What is the difference?
And here's another one for you. What would you say if I told you Lee Oswald was trained in the Russian language when he was a Marine?
I say he's probably getting intelligence training.
Well, if you were in the Marines, who'd be running that training?
Office of Naval Intelligence.
Take a look across the street.
Post office.
Upstairs in 1963, that was the Office of Naval Intelligence. Just by coincidence, Bannister, before he was FBI, was O&I. Now, what's that little saying they have?
Once O&I, always O&I.
Well, he likes working near his old pals.
Bill,
Lou, we are standing in the heart of the United States government's intelligence community in New Orleans. That's the FBI there. All right? That's the CIA. That's the Secret Service. That's the ONI. Now, doesn't this seem to you a rather strange place for a communist to spend his spare time?
On October 16, 1963, a little over a month before the assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald went to work at the Texas School Book Depository, located at the corner of Elm and Houston in Dealey Plaza. Dealey Plaza wasn't on the motorcade route until somebody changed the route on the morning of the fateful visit. Who had influence to change the president's route that day? Well, at the time of the assassination, Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell, brother of one-time Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Charles Cabell, had been a CIA asset since 1956. It is worth noting that Kennedy dismissed CIA Director Alan Dulles in November 1961 and that Earl Cabell's brother Charles left the CIA on January 31, 1962 after Kennedy forced him to resign. Thus, both Dulles and Charles Cabell were no longer working for the CIA on November 22, 1963 when Kennedy was killed. Earl Cabell, who had been elected mayor of Dallas in May 1961, oversaw arrangements for Kennedy's trip in motorcade, which took him through Dealey Plaza, a route that violated almost all standard rules for presidential safety, and where normal safeguards such as sealing windows and placing sharpshooters were ignored. This is of very high interest to researchers into the assassination, who have been collecting evidence of CIA ties to a host of individuals who figure in the events of November 22, 1963. Once the assassination took place, Oswald realized that he had been stepped in, well, let's just call it the soft and smelly. He returned to his rooming house and then to the Texas Theater. The theater was presumably a fallback meeting place with his controller when he was in trouble. He was in the theater when Officer Tippett was murdered by a man who was an Oswald lookalike, probably the same one who had been impersonating him for weeks leading up to the assassination. And by the way, there is a ton of evidence that this impersonating took place on numerous occasions. It was likely planned that Oswald should have been killed while resisting arrest at the Texas Theater, but he kept shouting, quote, "I'm not resisting arrest, I'm not resisting arrest," as he is being handcuffed by the Dallas police. As a result, this left the CIA with a problem, that Oswald could tell the Secret Service or FBI enough to cause the CIA to be disbanded and its senior management executed for the murder of the President of the United States. They couldn't allow this to happen, hence Oswald's murder by Jack Ruby. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, and it's on sale. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.